good afternoon. You've just turned into Faith and Reason. I'm Dr. John Pinheiro, host of the show, and for the next hour, we're going to be exploring the topic of urban architecture, urban planning, the good life, I think even baseball. We've got a whole great lineup here of things to talk about, and I've invited onto the program Professor Philip Best of the University of Notre Dame. Architecture is something I've grown very interested in recently because I've been serving on the Chapel Building Committee at Aquinas College, where I teach in Grand Rapids, and I just have mostly sacred architecture on my mind. But I've been looking at buildings differently, looking at floor plans differently, looking at the facades of buildings differently than I think I ever have before. And so as a consequence of that, I thought it'd be great to have an architect on the program. Professor Best teaches graduate urban design and theory at the University of Notre Dame with a particular interest in Catholic and classical humanist intellectual and artistic traditions. And he does so in the context of modern American life. So not, I think, in just sort of an abstracted way, curious about these things, but how can we apply those in the modern world? And I think that's great. From 2004 to 2014, he was the School of Architecture's Director of Graduate Studies. During the past decade, his urban design studios have completed master plan proposals for Lewis University in Illinois, Cooperstown, Northampton, Ventura, California. And as an award-winning designer, he's also designed a multi-year project called the Notre Dame Plan of Chicago 2109, which focuses upon contemporary metropolitan Chicago. And we were chatting a bit before the program, and that's kind of what's occupying Mr. Best's time these days. And so we'll be talking about that too, I expect. Grand Rapids we're a three-hour drive from Chicago here, but that's the closest major metropolitan area to West Michigan, Detroit being in an equal and opposite direction in the other way. Now, Professor Bass was also very involved with an effort to save Fenway Park, it was called. And so, Professor Bass, I'd like to welcome you to the program, and I think we'll get to talking about Fenway Park shortly.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Now, tell me a bit about the Save Fenway Park, which I have, as I understand it, was ultimately successful, and you personally, through your efforts, had an impact on seating and a number of things at Fenway Park, one of the more storied and famous ballparks in the country.
Yeah, I should clarify at the outset that that all of these projects and I'd say architecture and urban design generally are cooperative efforts. So I was part of a group of people who were working to save Fenway Park, and I was fortunate to be asked to put together a design team to come up with alternatives for saving Fenway Park. We came up with two. This was a workshop that was done in August of 2000, and there were a group of I think seven architects, myself included, that we came in and we worked with two local organizations. One was a fan organization, although that hardly describes their talents and what they do. But the fan organization was called Save Fenway Park, and then there was also a local community development corporation in the Fenway neighborhood where Fenway Park is located, and they. Together, invited me to put together a team to come in and hold this, I think it was about a 10-day workshop in Boston, where we came up with a couple of different alternatives. One, to reconstruct the grandstand of Fenway Park on its site and save the playing field and work within the constraints of the site. And then the other was just a kind of renovation proposal that would identify a number of things that could be done incrementally to improve Fenway's ability to generate revenue, but without losing the character and the quality of the place that everyone loves so much. And it was really the new ownership. The ownership changed hands not long after we did this this project, and the new owners came in and wound up adopting a lot of the proposals that we came up with in that August 2000 charrette, including, I think, most famously would be the seats on top of the wall, the so-called monster seats.
Okay, what's interesting to me is we have these lovely ballparks throughout the country. Some have since been replaced. I guess there's everything from a Candlestick to Yankee Stadium, and then we have this case of Fenway Park. And instead of building a new stadium, I assume that was the real alternative here was there was a push to give Boston a new stadium, which seems to be a push for many teams, football, baseball, really around the country. But we're talking baseball. Was that what you were opposed to, this group saving Fenway Park? Was there an effort to just replace it entirely?
Yeah, the proposal was to build a new Fenway Park adjacent to it to save a little portion of the old facility to replicate the idiosyncrasies of the existing playing field in a much larger footprint ballpark. Fenway and Wrigley are the sole survivors of a generation of ballparks that were built in the early 20th century. They were all built in the context of city neighborhoods, within the constraints of pre-existing city blocks, and so you had all of the parks from that generation, or almost all the parks from that generation, had idiosyncrasies in the shape of the playing field that were a direct consequence of their being constrained by their site. That's very obvious in the case of Fenway because you get the short left field wall. It's also the case in Wrigley that it's tightly constrained by the block. And now as then, baseball parks are built to generate revenue. And so that's the driving force behind any new baseball park. But what's been interesting is that Fenway and Wrigley, as survivors, they're extremely popular. They do an extremely good job of what stadiums are supposed to do, which is to make money for their teams. And so the danger is what we were worried about, what the fans in Fenway, the Save Fenway Park group, was worried about. Was that they would lose a park that was so much a part of the identity of the Red Sox that it would diminish the team and would thwart the efforts of the owners. So Wrigley's going through somewhat of the same thing right now, but those are the two survivors. But what makes them unique is that they were part of a neighborhood context and were constrained by the shape of the neighborhood.
So the importance of these parks in cities is this. What you covered this at length, I assume, in your book, City Baseball Magic, which is I haven't read that, but I know that was your first book, Plain Talk and Uncommon Sense about Cities and Baseball Parks. I've lived in Knoxville, Tennessee, and here in Grand Rapids, and in both places, either while I was living there, as in the case of Knoxville, or here, it had already happened before I moved to Grand Rapids to take up my job at Aquinas College. Ballparks were moved from their old urban and downtown locations, or close to downtown locations, to almost semi-rural. I mean, in areas that we'll talk about sprawl a bit later, but in kind of sprawlish areas, but definitely outside of the city limits. And then I don't think I quite understood the consequences of that till I had a good chance to go to Memphis, Tennessee, and to attend a conference. And there was their ballpark right downtown. And I think a window, was it a window even got shattered while I was there in an automobile from a home run, something like that. Uh-huh. And it really did kind of make the neighborhood. And I don't know the story of that Memphis park, but it really felt new. And I wondered if there's a movement not just to build these outside of towns now, but maybe to build them inside of towns so as to contribute to the good life of the citizens, of the people dwelling in the cities.
Yeah, that's you've touched upon a very interesting and complex phenomenon. I mean, what you've described, there's a trajectory over the past 20 year. I'm sorry, the past century. Ballparks, in that sense, really follow the culture, right? That the generation that we've been talking about, Wrigley and Fenway, were built in the context of city neighborhoods at a time when cities were doing better than they started to do after the Second World War. That after the Second World War, there was a real movement out to the suburbs. Cities were vacated. teams follow their fans, or at least they imagine they built new ballparks out in suburban environs, really to be accessible by automobile rather than by public transportation. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is that there began to be a reversal of that, beginning really in the late 80s and early 90s. To some extent, the book that you mentioned, City Baseball Magic, it documents a project that we did, a kind of counter proposal. And in this case, I was working for the Society for American Baseball Research for their ballparks committee. The project was to do a counter proposal to what the White Sox were proposing in Chicago, which was to essentially put a suburban-type stadium into an urban neighborhood, blow out the neighborhood, surround it with cars, surround it with parking. And we did an alternative to that showed how you could meet the programmatic needs of the team and yet build the ballpark in the context of the neighborhood and use the ballpark as a way to become a kind of center of a neighborhood that would promote development in the vicinity. Now, what's interesting is that Comiskey turned out to be the last suburban ballpark, because a year after Comiskey, the new Comiskey opened, Camden Yards opened. And Camden Yards really changed the landscape of mm-hmm. ballpark design toward more urban ballparks. But I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made, is that new stadiums began to be built downtown, and they were urban, but they weren't neighborhood ballparks.
Oh, I see.
And and so this is really a kind of important distinction, because for the last 30 years or so, 25 years or so, a lot of ballparks have been conceived as anchors for cities understood as entertainment zones. And so they're urban, but they're not neighborhood.
And there's still a place that you go to, but you don't live in that particular.
Yeah, pretty much, mm-hmm. pretty much. And where cities themselves, although again, this has started to change, but I would say for the first, you know, maybe until the mid 2000s or so, that these projects really was a matter of thinking of cities as entertainment zones. But now, of course, there's a much stronger move of residents back into cities, and that's a good thing. I think mm-hmm. that the problematic aspect of the growth of cities today has to do with class divisions and cities becoming enclaves of the wealthy. Not that it's bad to have the wealthy in cities, but poor people can't afford to live in cities.
I see.
Anymore.
Yeah,
so.
Right. We have areas in Grand Rapids that some would complain about exactly that seem to be revitalized areas, and then there's always concerns that some people will then be priced out of what had been their neighborhood right. for many years. One last note on baseball, and that is, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about Comerica Park in Detroit. And what your thoughts are on that. It sounds like an entertainment zone park, or do I read that incorrectly?
No, I think that's true. I mean, I think that, it's very interesting. I was involved with, of course, there was a long campaign to save Tiger Stadium. And I think the group was called the Tiger Stadium Fan Club. And I knew those folks and became friends with some of them. And they did a really heroic job. And I think it's interesting. The whole I'll get back to your question about Tiger about Comerica Park, but I have to say that my experience with Detroit kind of changed my mind about new baseball parks, because I think up until that time I had thought that you could we could demolish the old ballparks it was okay to demolish the old ones because we could build new ones that would be better. And I began to change my mind after that. Not because Comerica is particularly bad, but just because I realized that you know, when Tiger Stadium was lost, that you know, Fenway and Wrigley were the only ones left, and that they really needed defending. and that the however that the best new ones were not as good as at least the best of the old ones. And so I have not been to a game at Comerica Park. I did get to a game at Tiger Stadium in the last season. I've been by Comerica Park. My impression of it is that it's a nice enough newer ballpark. I mean, one of the big differences between the new ballparks and the old ones is that the new ones are just much, much bigger. They have a bigger footprint. The particularly the upper deck seats are much further away from the playing field, and these are all design issues that are related to how new stadiums invariably are designed with seats where there are no column obstructed seats. That's really a kind of a requirement, or at least a perceived requirement for new ballparks. So what that means is that the upper deck can't be on top of the lower deck supported by columns, but it has to be behind. And so it's much further away. So in Tiger Stadium, you could be very, very close in the upper deck.
Oh, I see.
But Comerica is of that different generation. I think, you know, everything that's going on in Detroit, it'll be interesting to see what if any kind of role Comerica Park plays there, because there are there's interesting entrepreneurial activity that's taking place in Detroit these days, and it's going to be interesting to see. Detroit is kind of a laboratory for I think what a lot of cities might be going through, how they might begin to revive themselves. So it's going to be an interesting test case. But I don't have enough experience of Comerica Park directly to really, I think, comment authoritatively, other than that it is an example of the modern type. And it is, I mean, Detroit did, I think, go down the wrong path in any number of cases trying to generate activity in their downtown by big scale projects. Comerica Park strikes me as being in that tradition, but it's possibly more successful than some of the other ones.
Oh, thank you. I think if you said something nice about the Tigers now, I think our listeners would really become big fans and rush out and buy all your books.
Well, playoff baseball is so frustrating, but but I mean, you know, you're talking to a Cub fan, so.
Oh, okay. We'll stop there.
You know, it's not enough to get to the playoffs, but we're suffice it to say that we've been frustrated. We know playoff frustration.
Sure. But. Well, your distinction between neighborhood and as opposed to the urban downtown intrigues me. Grand Rapids is a city, many of my friends say, and I think so too. It is a city of neighborhoods, and sometimes the city government seems to be a much more concerned or maybe even obsessed with downtown and getting people downtown. And we have these lovely, really urban villages. I live in one of them where I have everything within walking distance. I have
right.
I have a bank, a breakfast place that also serves lunch, a little coffee shop, a hardware store, a privately owned hardware store, a little grocery store, just about everything one would want, a public library even, all within walking distance.
And yeah.
It's a lovely, lovely way to live. And I thought maybe that could be our segue into talking about some of your other work. You've written in many places against sprawl. And I think most people would say, sprawl, that sounds terrible, but I'm not sure if we'd all know how to define it. I know that you got your master's in architecture from the University of Virginia, so you'll be familiar with how there's only so much you can do in the town of Charlottesville there yet, and yet you have, I don't remember the number of the highway now, but it kind of stretches on and on with sprawl towards Washington, D.C. as you head out of Charlottesville.
Yeah, I remember it was 29 or 31.
I'm thinking of 29.
I think it's 29.
Yeah, and it kind of goes and goes and goes, and maybe you haven't been there in many years. I know you finished there in the early 80s, but
I was just there last August.
Oh, were you? So okay. And you've been there more recently than I.
We noticed it.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
No, I just say notice the sprawl. It's unavoidable.
It's hard not to. And so here in Grand Rapids, we have stores come and go, and I'll be driving down one of our main thoroughfares here, 28th Street, and there's so many stores that are closed, and you look across the street, and they're building wholly new buildings and stores.
Right.
Or a fast food place moves from one side of the street to about 300 yards away on the other side of the street. And I think I wonder how we get to the balance where you have the right of an entrepreneur or a business owner to say, look, I'm going to get more revenue here, or more foot traffic, or more people, and we need this footprint or that footprint, or this building won't do for us anymore. We can't work things out with the landlord. It's cheaper just to build a whole new building sometimes, they'll right. say. And how do you balance those things, the freedom and entrepreneurship, the free economy, free enterprise, in other words, with I guess it would take a lot of rules and regulations to stop sprawl, wouldn't it?
Well, you've
that's a million questions.
It's a great question, but it underscores the complexity of the phenomenon and the complexity of any kinds of future scenarios and how those might play out. And which is actually not to try to lead into the plan of Chicago 2109, but those are exactly the kinds of issues that we're trying to imagine for Chicago 2109. But let's go back to the issue of what sprawl is and how to define it. That it's really I think that the best way to define it is that it is a physical environment in which uses are separated into zones. They're segregated into zones that are a sufficient distance from each other that they are only accessible by car. And that consequently what it represents is a built environment, an environment built around the automobile. And so I think that a lot of the criticism of critics of sprawl is that critics of sprawl are anti-automobile. But I think it's important to say that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. I think it's reasonable to look at automobiles as a great convenience. But that it's problematic when that we've created problems for ourselves by organizing the built environment around the automobile, and there are alternatives to do doing that where cars can still be conveniences and without dictating the shape of the landscape, and the alternative to that is the traditional city, the traditional city neighborhood, the traditional town, all of which, when I say traditional, I want to say largely, you know, the models are largely Western, European and American, but they have their analogs in other places in the world because they're built by human beings, and human beings they're fit places for human beings, and human beings have some common characteristics. So, but talking about that historic model of the traditional neighborhood, the traditional town, the way that I would describe it is that it is a variety of uses. It entails a variety of uses within pedestrian proximity of each other. And so it tends to be a little bit denser, generally tends to be denser than sprawl. But what it means is that the kind of environment that you described of your own little, you know, your neighborhood in Grand Rapids, where you have all of these activities within pedestrian proximity, that's the way that human beings lived prior to the advent of mechanical transportation. And so you really have the origins of suburbs are in the 19th century when you start having railroad suburbs that are organized around a train station that take people from, you know, from where they live to their jobs downtown. But everything else within the proximity of the train station is still this, mix of uses within pedestrian proximity. But what changes, it really changes, suburbia really changes, and sprawl comes into being after the Second World War. In the United States, where through a combination of governmental policies having to do with the creation of the interstate highway system, having to do with what kinds of residential buildings would receive, would be approved for veterans loans, for the federal housing policies, really encouraged building outside of center cities. They encouraged new construction rather than rehab of existing in-city construction. And sprawl became, over, you know, several decades, the kind of default position of a lot of American institutions, the law, financing expectations, the regulations or the expectations of bureaucratic agencies, the real estate industry, all of those kind of things. And yet, I have to say that sprawl would not have, if I think sprawl is properly understood as being promoted by the government rather than simply being a market phenomenon, and yet at the same time, it succeeds because it appeals to something deep, I think, in the American character. When I say succeeds, it's popular because it appeals to something deep in the American character that I think was in some best described by Tocqueville in Democracy in America I think it was in Volume 2, where he wrote about the democratic tendency toward individualism, and he has this description of how individualism is a novel historical phenomenon, not to be confused with selfishness, that where a man withdraws with his family and close circle of friends, and he forgets his forgets his ancestors and doesn't think about his progeny and imagines that he's kind of self-sufficient and self-contained, and what was lacking in 1840 were kind of the technological and market means in order, that would have made that available on a wide scale, and that happened after the Second World War.
So, so we get at the, I guess it's the age old quandary since the time of the Greeks. A Western man has been thinking about this balance between the individual and his community.
Yeah, and absolutely.
For several thousand years, mankind got around the same way, right? They walked or they rode horses until very, very recently. And I guess my next question, or what I'm thinking about now, listening to you talk about these things, is if the traditional state of towns is a result of, I guess, practicality, the happenstance that there was no better way to get – or quicker way, I should say, to get around, faster way to go over great distances. But now we have that. It seems like, as even you've said, the populist thing kind of made this successful. This is what they wanted. They didn't want to live downtown. They wanted to live outside of town. They wanted to live on a house, on an acre, rather than in an apartment. And I wonder how do we know that urban sprawl is bad as opposed to just new? I mean, we never had the technology before really to have this kind of urban sprawl.
Right. I mean, yeah. It's a very good question, and I think that temperamentally, I mean, there's the people who favor traditional neighborhoods, I suppose. They come in all temperaments, and there might be some who might think that it's necessary that there be laws that would require us to live more compact settlements, and those who think that that urbanism is good enough that they'd be happy if there was just a level playing field, because right now the legal and cultural and institutional apparatus of the contemporary world is organized to create sprawl rather than to allow compact mixed-use development. So I think there's a lot of us who would just be happy if there could be a level playing field and that it would be possible to make traditional urban form as of right rather than as something that you have to jump through a lot of hoops, which you don't really have to do if you're making a sprawl environment. But I think that there's another issue aside from the idea that people should be free to live in the kind of community that they want. I think that's true to some extent, but with certain limits on that. I think that the limits are limits imposed by reality, not limits imposed by government. And let me just give a couple. I mean, one argument about the problems of sprawl is that it's environmentally problematic. It consumes landscape. It pollutes the air. Those kinds of arguments. Now, cars have started to burn cleaner. So that's we don't want to underestimate human ingenuity. To me, the more compelling argument is an economic argument, which is that is that ultimately we won't be able to afford the cost of sprawl infrastructure. And what I mean by that are all of the kinds of highway and sanitary conditions that suburban sprawl requires. And the reason we won't be able to sustain that is because the density is insufficiently high to generate the tax revenues to pay for it. It was there's a guy in Minnesota, actually a politically conservative guy, interesting. His name is Chuck Marone, and he's got an organization called StrongTowns.org, and he's really done a lot of good work analyzing particular cases of tax revenue generation, comparing sprawl to traditional patterns of more compact development. And he wrote a very influential article about sprawl as a Ponzi scheme, in which he pointed out, analogizing sprawl to a Ponzi scheme, in which he pointed out the circumstances under which the first generation of sprawl infrastructure was built. It was financed by the federal government and then turned over to the municipalities to sustain. After a generation, it had to be repaired and sustained, and municipalities, so this is in the 80s, and municipalities would pass bonds to do this. And we've now reached the next generation where it has to be repaired again, but those bonds aren't paid off, and the funds aren't available from the federal government. And it also coincides with changes in demographic patterns. We're talking about a suburban environment where a lot of the buildings aren't really built to last more than 50 years. They're not especially well built, and you've got a circumstance where they're designed to house families of a certain size and income bracket that don't exist, or if they exist, that don't exist in that. At that same scale, and so demographically, I think that there's an argument, and it's a hypothesis, right? That the economics and the demographics of sprawl don't make sprawl sustainable. So it's not so much a matter of demanding that sprawl go away as thinking that what was Herbstein's law: if something is unsustainable, it will stop.
So we're talking about an amelioration of this at this point, or looking for a remedy. I mean, because we have sprawl now, right? So we can't we can't build a new perfect traditional town from the ground up. I mean, I guess we can, but we're not going to do that in most places. So
not in most places. I think in most places it's a matter of infilling and taking advantage of existing infrastructural resources.
Grand Rapids, I think, has been doing. I think the city's done a pretty darn good job of that. I think so in recent years, from what I've seen, at least in the downtown area. That is taking old buildings and refurbishing them without necessarily tearing them down or building, an ugly structure in its place or a parking lot, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I did some work in Grand Rapids about 15 years ago, so I have some acquaintance with Grand Rapids, and my impression of the city is that it was a really great community. There's a lot of civic initiative from the private sector.
Very much.
I think one of the big issues in new urbanism is this argument about whether or not good places make people better, or whether good places are products of good communities. I think that there's a reciprocity between character and environment, but it's certainly the case that if you've got a better community, then if they become conscious of the built environment, I think that they're going to make better built environments.
Well, this is Dr. John Pinheiro, and you're listening to Holy Family Radio, and the show is Faith and Reason. I'm talking with Professor Philip Bass at the University of Notre Dame about the new urbanism and sprawl and a variety of issues related to this. And Professor, you've just given us an answer in terms of economics and demographics and other reasons why we would want to not only avoid sprawl, but fix the sprawl that we have and return to more traditional sized and, I guess, a humane scale of our communities. I wonder if there's something then in the human person that cries out for this, our natural desire for beauty and community, that the pagan Greeks recognized these things and certainly Christians recognized these things. And we talk a lot on Faith and Reason. We talk a lot about Christian anthropology and how when we talk about the liberal arts education or educating the human person, that without a Christian anthropology, even the idea of the liberal arts falls apart. And I wonder if we could bring that over into the urban planning realm. So it's those kinds of arguments, I guess, for beauty may be a harder sell to politicians and planners than economic and demographic arguments. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that, on our natural desire for orderliness and beauty and living in community. Even agrarians talk about communities, but they're different in structure, I guess, in size. But even they would talk about community.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a great question. It's absolutely central to certainly to the way I've been thinking about architecture and urbanism for three decades or so, and it's very much central to the way that we teach architecture and urbanism at Notre Dame. I think that the interesting, and taking this back to Aristotle, because Aristotle is really, I think, the fountainhead of systematic thinking about cities. And I think he's usually acknowledged for that, I think, in terms of the politics and the political order of cities and the moral order of cities. But it has implications. I mean, the politics does refer also to physical characteristics of what he regarded as the best cities. And of course, that wasn't his primary interest, but those kinds of things have been picked up by subsequent generations of people who are more specifically concerned with architecture and urban design. And of course his idea of the city in the Christian imagination was expanded and enlarged through the Christian understanding of the New Jerusalem and the Book of Revelation and Augustine and the City of God. But Aristotle gets some foundational things correct, where he talks about in the politics that communities exist or communities are defined by what groups of people have in common, some shared telos, right? That human beings have that's what forms a community, generally, these kinds of activities with their, designated ends, they're finite. And he says there's nothing wrong with this, but they're, we do things to pursue certain goods, and we do them, when we share these ends, then we're a community. But he says a city is a different thing altogether, because a city is a community of communities that the purpose of which is to promote human flourishing, right? That there's no other end that's higher than that, and that the city itself is a community of communities, and so it has its own it requires its own virtues, it requires its own political arts in order to succeed. It has an economic foundation. I mean, it includes all of these kinds of activities that human beings do, and he argues that that the foundation of the city is the family, right? As the family and the village is foundational for procuring the necessities of life, but that cities are the place where human beings thrive and flourish and go beyond simple survival, but actually become everything that we're capable of being. And so that's really the tradition within which we're working, and that's I think an understanding of cities that traditional urbanists have carried forward for over 2,000 years.
So where do we find or what is the role of sacred places then in the new urbanism? If we were looking at traditional towns, most, of course, in the Christian West, cities and towns alike would have a very central either cathedral or church, a small church, a large church, a church with a very, very public space around it, piazza, that sort of thing. How does that figure into rebuilding traditional cities now? It seems like that would be very contested, so that we might end up with a ballpark in an urban area or in a neighborhood.
Yeah.
But there's going to be lots of different kinds of churches, and which one becomes central to the community? Is it happenstance? And so I'm curious, when it comes to urban planning, what you as a Notre Dame professor who's authored your book Till We Have Built Jerusalem: Architecture, Urbanism, and the Sacred, which was published by ISI in 2006. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, when we talk about city, when I talk to my students about cities, I try to give them a sense of the complexity of what cities are and what they entail. And I tell them that empirically we can say several things about cities. That cities are always and everywhere a kind of environmental order. They are how the human, and by city we don't mean a modern big city like Chicago. We're talking at the scale of Aristotle and of the polis, of the scale of the modern scale of a neighborhood. But so for Aristotle, the size of a city was, the population of a city might have been 5 to 20,000 people, and it might have been a mile or a half mile square, something like that. So it was walkable, right? And so, the point that I make with students is that cities always and everywhere are an environmental order that represents how the human animal occupies the landscape, and we do it in a better or a worse way, in a way that if it's sustainable, if we occupy it in a sustainable way, we can continue to occupy the same place over generations. And if we fail to do that in a sustainable way, then we have to move, and the city doesn't succeed. That the city is also an economic order. Everywhere that the city, production and exchange of goods, that it's a moral order, that it requires human beings to work out ways of living with each other justly and in order to live well, that justly and prudently, and that it's a formal order, right? That a city always takes place. It has a physical form. And then there's a fifth one that I've always just taken for granted, but it's I've realized in the last couple of years that I can't take it for granted. And that is, a city is always a demographic order. And we always just take that for granted, but when faced with the prospect of cities that are shrinking in population, or with declining fertility rates and the prospect that populations are going to shrink, it focuses your mind on the reality that cities are also a demographic order. And all of these orders interact with each other in reciprocal ways, so that a city at any one time is all of these things, and they act upon one another in greater and lesser ways to constitute what a city is. But then there's this larger question of whether or not cities exist within sacred order. And that, I would say, is the big dividing line between traditional cities and certainly the modern city. The modern city, I think, has no... grace occurs where it will. So the modern city is not a place that's devoid of God's grace. But in terms of the physical characteristics of the modern city and the extent to which it represents or acknowledges sacred order in some way, the modern city really doesn't do that. whereas the traditional city does. And so the, all of the things that you mentioned about the traditional European city, where the culture was predominantly Christian, right? And so you would have, you'd have the public plaza fronted by, fronted by a church. You'd have a street that would, terminate, axially at the end of the street, on a church. And the churches themselves were all part of a common culture, right? So they would be different parish churches, or they would be churches belonging to different religious orders, or they would, one would be a cathedral. I mean, so there are hierarchies, but there was a kind of, shared religious sensibility that was embodied, a shared sacred sensibility that was embodied in the arrangement of religious buildings to public space. When you get to the United States, and you get to the, particularly in the United States, with a competing religious traditions and religious pluralism, you still have religion represented, the sacred represented. In public space, in the location of churches that, but it's not, but there are different denominations, right? So there's ways in which, the form of the city, in the United States, up until, the last 50 years, up until the modernist era, represented, and acknowledged that cities exist in a context of sacred order, because again, this is what church buildings do, right? One of the things that church buildings do, they're in the earthly city, but they represent the heavenly city, and they point us to a sacred context beyond ourselves. And so the big question, I think, today, and not only within among modernist urban designers and modernist architects who are, I would say that the modern city is thoroughly secularized in its formal order, and that this is true even among modernist designers who might be religious believers, but they don't, they don't understand well. So that's one issue. But then you've got. In the modern world, the modern city doesn't symbolize sacred order, and I think that's just a big debate that's going to occur between people who have a religious sensibility and people who have a secularist sensibility.
And we've used the word community, and my understanding of the original Greek usage of the term implies, a community by definition has boundaries, and those boundaries are culture, which is rooted in religion, language, and all these commonalities, so that there's the people in the community, there's the people outside the community. And I'm thinking in terms of our American cities, if we can't agree on the sacred, to what degree are we maybe laboring in vain to think that we can make our cities communities if we all don't respond respond to the transcendent, respond to God in the same way? European city, especially in the pre-Reformation, of course, there's going to be a cathedral, there's going to be the parish churches, et cetera, and it's obvious. And as Thomas Merton says at one point in the Seven Story Mountain, looking at the town where he was born in France, he said that the church made the whole rest of the town intelligible. It was at its right center. It pointed upward. You couldn't miss it. He says a variety of things about it. And I think as a professor at a liberal arts college, I often think I really don't know how I would teach about the liberal arts without possessing a Christian anthropology and believing in everything from the natural law to our natural desire for beauty and these sorts of things. And I wonder then, as an urban planner, and you're producing something like the Notre Dame plan of Chicago 2109, which is a very Catholic city on the other hand, but there's of course a variety of all kinds of people. How do you balance it? How do you do that?
Yeah, well, let's see.
It's contested, but so what?
Yeah.
What do you do? I don't want to say we're laboring in vain. I don't think that's the case, but there's got to be a point of diminishing returns if Aristotle called it a community of communities.
Right. Well, and I would say the questions that you're asking, the answers to the questions that you're answering are contested, what I believe and what I tell my students is that the kind of work that we're doing is a long-term cultural project, and that they need to know how to do good work and understand what good work is and understand why it is they're doing it, and that's their vocation, and that's the best that's really what's required of them. What form does that take, and how do we understand how do Catholics in particular, because that's a live issue for me as a Catholic, it's a live issue for us at Notre Dame members of a Catholic intellectual community. What does that require of us? Even at Notre Dame, where there's some shared larger shared principles about that, those issues are contested. But I think that in the case of Chicago and in the case of the United States, I think that there's a lot to be said. Well, meaning in Chicago and the United States, where religious pluralism is a fact, there is a lot to be said for respecting religious freedom and recognizing that religious freedom exists not as something that is granted to us by the state, but rather it is acknowledged by the state and the state's acknowledgement of it is really an acknowledgement that the state is not competent to adjudicate religious disputes.
Absolutely.
And so I think our premise in the Chicago project that you mentioned is that religious pluralism continues to exist, but that it has a place in the public square, right? It has a place in public, and I will say in public squares as well, because the alternative to that is to cede all authority to the state, or sometimes in the case of a place like Chicago, to commerce, there's a certain sense in which we understand Chicago as a city of neighborhoods, where historically the parish churches have played within neighborhoods the kind of role that parish churches played in European cities. We imagine that could continue, should continue. I think that the larger symbolic thing that we were concerned about in the Chicago 2109 plan is whether and how it's possible to register some kind of formal, physical, spatial acknowledgement of sacred order at a scale that in a way can hold its own with the symbolic representation of commerce and with the symbolic representation of government. But those are live questions for us.
You mentioned a long-term cultural project, it made me think of my own college, Aquinas College, here in Grand Rapids. And we've done a lot of building in recent years of apartment buildings because of our increased student numbers. We have a second phase of a sports and athletic center opening just later in October. Actually, I'm not sure when this program's airing. It may be open by the time this program airs. But another project we have in the works is to build, it will be our first chapel built as a chapel and dedicated to that purpose as a sacred space. And one of the conversations we're having is where to locate it. And it's part of a larger conversation about ways to renew and deepen and increase, and I guess I would even say revitalize our historic Catholic identity. And it seems to many of us at the college that one way to do that is of course a chapel, and thinking about the good that can be done by a beautiful chapel and a beautiful liturgy in the culture, and even in a long-term culture of a college for both faculty and students. Students are there for 4 to 5 years, we hope four, but 4 to 5 usually, and the faculty are there much longer. We've hired on your colleague, I'm sure you know him, Duncan Stroik, to begin the our planning phase and consulting phase for this. We're very, very excited about it. I'm sure you're familiar with Duncan's work.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. No, he has a great body of work, and it's growing. So.
Yeah, so we're excited to do that. And so that's really what got me thinking about the placement, I guess, of churches in the new urban movement and the new urbanism in the villages. We have there's a Christian Reformed Church in my neighborhood, and you know I'm Catholic, but they do some very interesting things in the neighborhood that don't seem necessarily church oriented. They're the kind of thing that any neighborhood community organization might do. Carnivals, picnics, ice cream things, you know, and,
right.
And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing for the neighborhood, but it really is interesting in America when you have such a patchwork of churches. And sometimes,
yeah.
Of course, they're competing for parishioners, and I'm not sure. I don't know if that's good or bad for the a neighborhood.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think it's good for religious ideas to compete. I think that the alternative, you know, the alternative where ideas would be suppressed and religious ideas in particular,
yeah,
I think wouldn't be so great. But I take your point. I'm very happy. I'm very happy to learn actually that you're working with Duncan. Before Joseph Ratzinger became Pope Benedict, he gave an interview. I can't remember the name of the book. It was in the 80s, but in the course of which he made the comment that I just so completely agree with. He said something to the effect that the best apologia for Christian faith are the saints that the church has produced and the beauty of its art. That even more than apologetics, even more than the Catholic intellectual tradition, which you know obviously he regards as extremely important, that these are less important in terms of making a prominent positive impression of Christianity in the world than the church's saints and the art that the church has nurtured. And I completely agree with that. And those things are not mutually exclusive, and they're vocations proper to those who have those vocations. Well, I suppose we all have a vocation to sanctity,
I think that was the Ratzinger report.
It was the Ratzinger report. But I think that is so absolutely correct, and it's part of what's so disheartening, I think, about the state of much of modern art and Catholic art. Over the last 50 years, so there's a job of retrieval to be done, and we at Notre Dame and Duncan is very much part of that, and I think we understand ourselves as trying to re-engage that tradition and relearn it and extend it.
Yeah, beauty, that kind of beauty speaks directly to the human heart and a need we all have, and those of us who can't intellectualize that need, we still have it. And that's a great that attracts people to the faith and the truth and God. And Professor Philip Bass, I'd like to thank you very much for being on Faith and Reason today and talking about a wide range of things from urban planning to churches to baseball stadia. It's really been enjoyable and pleasant to have you on the program.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it very much.
This is Dr. Pinero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. As always, I'd like to thank my producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Without his energy and planning, I don't think this program could get off the ground, so I'd like to thank him very much. And also Ben Muldrink, who works in the booth for us, and all the people at Holy Family Radio. Please have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinheiro is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.